If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's podcast guest is Roland White, a historian and author specialising in aviation. He's the author of Harrier 809, which tells the story of the 1982 Falklands War by zoning in on the part played by the Sea Harrier jump jet and the reformed 809 squadron. Roland spoke to BBC History Magazine editor Rob Attar.
Roland, you've written several books on aviation history before. What was it that drew you to the story you've covered in this book?
Well, I was 11 years old when the Falklands War was fought. And I suppose as a kid growing up in the 70s, I'd made Airfix models and I'd read Commando comic and things. I think, you know, anyone who grew up in the 70s had a childhood sort of infused by the sort of legends and stories of the Second World War. And of course, in 1982, the outbreak of the Falklands War, there was this sort of aeroplane-obsessed 11-year-old boy who was suddenly able to follow in real time, day by day, events in the South Atlantic. And we had this sort of very memorable Ministry of Defence spokesman called Ian MacDonald, who every day would come on and announce that the Sea Harrier fighter bomber aircraft had shot down this many Argentinian planes, or, you know, this ship had been sunk, or this battle had been won. And, you know, it's tremendously exciting. And I hope I've got a slightly more grown up perspective on it all now. But as an 11-year-old boy, I was sort of seizing on the papers every day and rifling through them.
So this is a book almost that was conceived in your childhood, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true of all the books I've written. It's been this incredible opportunity to get to grips with some of the stories that I first became aware of as a child and meet and talk to some of the people involved. I mean, that's an incredible privilege and sort of a dream come true. I mean, if you told me when I was 11 years old that I'd be getting to know some of the pilots involved, I'd been bouncing down the street in happiness.
And for those of people who may not know a huge amount about this story, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the Sea Harrier and what its story was prior to the Falklands War.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, I think prior to the Falklands War, for all that it had been in service for, over a decade with the Royal Air Force and much more recently the Royal Navy as the Sea Harrier, I think it was, in certain circles, perceived as a sort of air show novelty. You know, it did this this hovering thing, vertical takeoff, and it would pirouette and bow to audiences at air shows. And yet there was very much a view that I think was quite widespread, that it was, as a warplane, incapable of carrying a box of matches from one side of a football pitch to the other. And I think the Falklands War was this sort of opportunity for it to silence its critics. And it did that, obviously, in no uncertain terms.
And now your book focuses specifically on 809 Squadron. And the formation of that squadron is quite interesting because, am I right to say, it wasn't actually put together until the war had begun?
Oh, that's right. There were two frontline Sea Harrier squadrons, one assigned to each of the two aircraft carriers we had at the time. And after the invasion, it was realised that this tiny force of frontline Sea Harriers that we had, and by scraping together a few more from the headquarters squadron at Royal Naval Air Station Yeovilton, we managed to put together 20, which sailed south on the 5th of April. It was realised that if there was going to be a shooting war, there was every possibility that we were going to lose some of those 20 Sea Harriers, and that 20 could quickly become 15, could quickly become 10, and the air defence of the fleet would no longer be a viable proposition. And so there was an urgent effort to try and put together reinforcements for that small Sea Harrier force, and the decision was made that the easiest and most effective way of doing that was to form a brand new squadron using aeroplanes taken out of deep storage, attrition replacements, some from British Aerospace, some from test squadrons, and pull pilots back, often from exchange programs in Australia or America, Germany as well, to fly, train them up and fly them very, very quickly. After the squadron was formed on the 7th of April, they had less than 3 weeks before they were then sent south to fight.
And why do you think that Britain was seemingly so underprepared for this conflict, and having to pull planes and pilots from all kinds of places, not having this force ready to go already?
Well, certainly the Fleet Air Arm had always been something of a Cinderella service. From the sort of heyday of the end of the Second World War through to the mid-60s, it was a large force flying off. At the end of the war, there were scores of carriers, but by the 60s, there were five or six large carriers, all of which had squadrons of fighters and bombers. But as Britain withdrew from empire, the need for large numbers of carriers to sort of cover that withdrawal reduced and reduced. And by the mid-60s, the decision was taken to end the large carrier force and to concentrate solely on the North Atlantic and our commitment to NATO. In support of that, we developed an anti-submarine force, and there's a feeling that perhaps a small force of fighters to fly off those carriers would be useful. But really, they were only intended to kind of deter Soviet patrol planes. It was never felt that with that pivot in our interests and our defence posture, there was going to be a need for large fleet carriers carrying squadrons of fighters in the same way that the Americans had. So it was really a question of what, as a country, we had decided to focus on. As Dennis Healy said when he took the decision not to replace HMS Ark Royal, the last of Britain's big deck carriers, as the Navy had made their case, he said the only scenario which was never presented to me was the invasion of the Falkland Islands. And that was clearly a scenario in which only a carrier could provide air cover, whereas in all the other situations that he had looked at and been asked to consider, there was at least the possibility of providing land-based air cover.
So on that point, could you just give us a sense of how important the aircraft carriers were to the task force that went to the Falklands?
Well, they were vital. Sir Henry Leach, who was chief of the naval staff, first Sea Lord at the time, said, without the Sea Harrier, there could have been no task force. So without the Sea Harrier, the Falkland Islands would still be in the hands of the Argentinians. I mean, there's simply no doubt about that. Sandy Woodward, who was the admiral leading the task force, said that he felt that conceivably if they'd lost Invincible, the smaller of the two carriers, he could have continued the operation, but that if he'd lost Hermes, which was the bigger of the two aircraft carriers, they'd have just had to pack up and go home. I mean, without the Sea Harriers, without those two carriers, there could have been no effort to retake the Falkland Islands. And so the book is really not just about the recreation of Harrier of 809 Squadron, but turned into, as I was researching it, an account of the wider effort at home, at sea, but also actually on the South American mainland to make sure that the carriers were kept safe from air attack.
And so once the squadron and these Harriers arrived in the South Atlantic, what were their kind of day-to-day responsibilities?
Well, they would mount round the clock, or certainly by daylight, round the clock combat air patrols at really over the islands to try to maintain or establish air superiority. And through the night, they would keep Harriers on alert, ready to intercept any possible attack from the Argentinians. So the reason for those combat air patrols was to establish an environment in which it would be possible to mount an amphibious assault on the islands. So the only way to actually retake the islands was to defeat the Argentinian forces on the islands. You could maintain a blockade, but that's actually not getting rid of them. You could establish air superiority over the islands, but that's not getting rid of them. The only way to actually remove them physically is to put soldiers on the islands and defeat them in battle. Really, the only way in which you can mount an amphibious assault like that, an opposed amphibious assault like that, is to give yourself something resembling air superiority so that landing, those amphibious landings, can't be attacked. I mean, that was true on D-Day, and it was true when we put forces ashore in the Falkland Islands as well. It's a prerequisite, if you like, for mounting an amphibious assault.
And then one thing that you cover in your book actually as well is the Argentine side and the air forces that they had. What kind of opposition were the men flying the Sea Harriers facing?
Well, they were a professional air force. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And they were equipped with what were at the time, if not state-of-the-art, certainly not obsolete, aircraft in the form of Skyhawk, supersonic Mirage, which had on paper at any rate superior performance to the Sea Harrier, and then the carrier-based Skyhawks and super Etendards of the Argentine Navy as well. So I mentioned that there were 20 Sea Harriers, and that was reinforced by the eight Harriers of 809 Squadron that went south on Atlantic Conveyor. But there were about 200 serviceable frontline fast jets in the Argentine order of battle. And so we were outnumbered 10 to 1. You know, that there were certain factors that worked in favour of the British. We had the most advanced air-to-air missile in the form of the AIM-9L Sidewinder, which the Americans had supplied us, which gave us some advantage in dogfights. But more than anything else, it was the training that the British pilots enjoyed that gave them confidence and I suppose the knowledge, the wherewithal, the skill to get the best of the Argentine forces through membership of NATO. All those British fighter pilots had enjoyed training against the very best the Americans, the French, the Germans, the Italians, Spanish had to offer against the most advanced and capable fighters in the world. And the Argentines, for all that they were brave and that they were skilled and they were equipped with decent airplanes, just lacked that sort of fantastically rigorous peer-on-peer training that the British pilots enjoyed.
And so I suppose, and even though some of the pilots in 809 Squadron hadn't had that much time on the Sea Harrier, their combined previous training was what set them apart from...
That's absolutely right, yeah. I mean, I enjoy telling people that some of the pilots who flew the Sea Harriers in 809 Squadron had had less time in the cockpit of those Sea Harriers than some of the young pilots who were sent into war during the Battle of Britain in their Spitfires and Hurricanes. But the truth is, as you rightly point out, although they had very little time in the cockpit of a Sea Harrier, they often had a lot of experience in one of the Royal Air Force Harriers, or prior to that, the Phantoms and Buccaneers of the Fleet Air Arm, or the Lightnings that they had flown for the Royal Air Force. So there was actually an enormous amount of combined experience within 809 Squadron. It's just that very often it all hadn't been found on the Sea Harrier itself.
And for the pilots themselves, this must have been both, I suppose, an exhilarating but also a pretty terrifying experience to do something that they probably had never experienced before, and, you know, where their lives were on the line in this way.
Well, certainly, you know, they weren't blind to the possibility that they might not be coming home. And indeed, you know, there were a number of Sea Harrier pilots who tragically lost their lives there. None, I should add, through air combat, but through accidents, tragic accidents. But I think that probably more than fear and anxiety, although certainly that was present, many of the Sea Harrier pilots regarded it as an opportunity to prove themselves and prove the Sea Harrier, prove doubters wrong. Certainly Nigel Ward, Sharky Ward, as he was known, who was the boss of 801 Squadron on Invincible, actually relished the opportunity to take the Sea Harrier into combat, because he felt that it was an aeroplane that was misunderstood, that was underrated, and that deserved an opportunity, as I say, to prove those doubters wrong. And it did so, obviously, in some style.
Yes, and as you just said earlier, there were no Sea Harriers lost in air combat, whereas they did kill a number of Argentines. So do you put that success down more to the plane or to the pilots?
It's a combination of both. And contributing to that also were the circumstances under which the Argentinians had to operate. They were at about 300 miles from their home bases, and often carrying quite heavy weaponry, at the limits of their range and endurance. So they weren't really in a position where they could engage in long, drawn-out air battles. They weren't in a position where they could make the most of the superior performance of those Mirages. So it wasn't entirely one-sided. There were challenges faced by both the Sea Harrier pilots and the Argentinian pilots. But I think, you know, in the end, it was that superior training that paid off, rather than any innate superiority of the Sea Harrier. The Argentinians certainly were concerned that they knew the British pilots had these more advanced missiles, and that gave them that gave the British a certain advantage, in the same way that, you know, when Mike Tyson stepped into the ring, the opponents were half beaten already, because they'd seen how destructive he had been in previous bouts. You know, that confidence counts for a lot. You know, if you're always watching your tail, you're likely to be a little bit less front-footed and aggressive in your own approach to the fight. Certainly luck played its part as well. But the Sea Harrier had very significant attributes in air combat. Below sort of 15, 20,000 feet, at sort of low to medium altitudes, it had an enormous excess of power, which meant that should it get caught in a turning fight, it was able to rapidly increase its speed and get its energy back. And it was the ability of an aeroplane to gain speed again quickly, because speed is key in a dogfight, that is often the key to success. And as I said, at low altitude, the Sea Harrier had that excess power it needed in abundance. And so the trick was to try to keep those fights at low level rather than get drawn up to higher altitudes, where the Argentinians would enjoy, you know, a greater advantage.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I mean, that's the kind of distance we're talking about. And so to maintain a supply chain, the logistics, which are absolutely critical to the successful prosecution of any campaign, the logistics chain was, it was magnificent.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
So, as you said, the Sea Harriers performed really well and won a number of victories. But had a few gone the other way, how much danger might they have been? I mean, how close run a thing was it?
Well, I think it really was a close run thing. I mean, we've seen that the Argentinians had the ability to sink British ships. The British ships went down to the South Atlantic with the retirement of Ark Royal in 1979, without there being any kind of airborne early warning system to pick up and detect raids at an early enough time to mount a really successful interception before they were in an opportunity to fire their missiles. So there was always this terrible risk of exposing the carriers to the possibility of an attack by those Exocet missiles. If one of those missiles had got through, if one of those carriers had been hit and sunk or put out of action, even, then, as Sandy Woodward was quick to point out, the war could have gone a very different way. And the other thing that is critical is just the distance. If you think about it, the distance that Britain was operating away from home. I mean, 8,000 miles is an enormous distance to be operating away from home. It's as if you were fighting a war in Western China, but mounting it from the UK. I mean, that's the kind of distance we're talking about. And so to maintain a supply chain, the logistics, which are absolutely critical to the successful prosecution of any campaign, the logistics chain was, it was magnificent and an extraordinary thing to have pulled off. Before the war, senior figures in the Pentagon and in the US Navy were advising the politicians that this was not a war that Britain could win. Certainly, the kit that we had, it was capable, but we were so far from home that we were a very, very thin dark blue line, if that's how you might want to describe the task force.
But as we know then, whether, through skill and through fortune, Britain did prevail. And how important do you think the Sea Harrier's contribution was to that ultimate victory?
Well, I mean, it was certainly one of the more eye-catching elements of the campaign. You know, we, in a number of days of quite intense combat, and the Sea Harrier shot down 23 enemy aircraft. They prevented on occasions ships being attacked and sunk. They certainly allowed the amphibious operation to take place and take place successfully, and allow the British amphibious forces, the Paras, the Royal Marines, to establish a presence on the islands from which they could break out and attack the defending Argentinian forces. None of that could have happened without the Sea Harrier, and so you know it was. Certainly, one of the key weapons of the campaign, without which it couldn't have been won.
And earlier you mentioned that the Sea Harrier, prior to the war, has a reputation perhaps almost like a show pony rather than a really effective weapon of war. Did that change with what happened in the Falklands?
Oh, without a doubt. You know, the Sea Harrier from that point on had won its spurs in a real shooting war and was treated with a great deal more respect. Now, it was very interesting to stumble across a quote when I was working on the book from the admiral in charge of the Soviet Navy, Gorshkov, who, when the Indians were thinking about what they might use on their aircraft carriers, just told them by the Sea Harrier. So, you know, the forces that the Sea Harrier had been designed to tackle, the Warsaw Pact forces, had a good deal of respect for it as an aeroplane. I think it surprised everybody at every turn, you know, ultimately established a very strong reputation as a very capable aeroplane. And it was developed through its service life between 1982 and 2006, when it was retired, into what was arguably the most capable fighter in Europe for a while. And so it was an impressive piece of kit. But, you know, it was definitely an aeroplane which, with that sort of battle-proven tag, was viewed very differently after the war to, I think, the way it was seen before the war.
And then what became of the men of 809 Squadron? Because as you mentioned, a lot of them were pulled out of regular jobs. They weren't necessarily actually involved in the military at the time. Did they go back to their old lives afterwards?
Yeah, some of them did. Two members of 809 Squadron certainly went on to command, in fact, three went on to command naval air squadrons of their own after the war. One, Tim Gedge, who was the commanding officer, got a role inside the Ministry of Defence, where he was largely responsible for drawing up the requirements for the Sea Harrier's replacement. And that is about to go to sea aboard Queen Elizabeth on operations for the first time, the new aircraft carrier, Queen Elizabeth, for the first time. That's the F-35, which is going to be equipping the return of 809 Squadron in the next couple of years when that's reformed again. And so, you know, they had enjoyed, many of them, quite long and successful careers in the Fleet Air Arm prior to the Falklands. A number of them enjoyed continuing success after that. One of them, John Leeming, who scored 809's only kill during the war, and it was a very dramatic dogfight low over Falkland Sound, where he attacked an Argentine Skyhawk that had just thrown bombs into HMS Ardent. And brought it down with his cannon rather than with a missile, and then flew through the sort of fireball that ensued. He sadly was killed in an air-to-air collision shortly after the war. So I hope I've been able to sort of bring his story to life and record that in a way that will you know, be memorable for people, because you know, he can't now speak for himself. I was very lucky to find a diary that he'd kept or been asked to write, I think, by the Royal Air Force after the war. So I was able to draw on some of his sort of firsthand recollections of the fighting, which were sort of shot through with the sort of sense of humour that everybody told me he had, but also some very vivid descriptions of the fighting, including the prickles on the back of his neck as he entered that dogfight.
And you have also spoken for the book to many surviving veterans of the conflict. How do they look back on the war now, nearly 40 years on?
Well, I think it varied. I think 809 Squadron as a whole had felt that in comparison to perhaps the two existing frontline squadrons, their story had been rather forgotten. And I felt that in many ways it was the most remarkable. It's got a sort of Dirty Dozen feel to it. You know, they were pulled together at short notice from all around the world, given some very rudimentary training about which button did what, and then thrown into combat as a piece of storytelling. That's you know, that's a gift. And I think that sort of feeling that perhaps they hadn't enjoyed the credit that they deserved was certainly there. But also the immediacy of the war and the fighting was right there for a number of them as well. You could tell, talking to them, just how close to the surface the tension, the fear, the sort of sense of battle stress that they had endured during the war still remained. You know, there were moments where I was sort of talking to Sir Mike Layard, who'd been the senior naval officer on board Atlantic Conveyor, when it was sunk, and that was the ship that took 809 Squadron down, and he was a former Fleet Air and Fighter pilot himself. And I was just on the edge of my seat hearing his account of events there and of the death of his friend Ian North, who was master of Atlantic Conveyor. They were the last two off the ship, and North sadly didn't make it onto one of the life rafts, and he had survived being sunk in the Second World War as a member of the Merchant Navy during the Battle of the Atlantic. There were these you know, really remarkable and sort of vivid firsthand stories brought to life, which I felt very privileged to hear. But as I said, even though that they took place almost 40 years ago, they were still vividly recalled and, you know, very obviously very, very close to the surface.
Okay, Roland, I think I've been through all the questions I was planning to ask you. Is there anything more that you think we really should have discussed that I hadn't brought up yet?
It's probably my fault for not weaving it into one of the answers to one of the questions. But I think the way that the book developed as I was researching it, which I found tremendously exciting and a little unexpected, because I initially thought it was going to be quite a short, sharp, focused account of 809's war. But I realised as I got into it that nobody had really looked at the archives since they'd been declassified and released under the 30-year rule. So I went through them with a fine-tooth comb, realizing that it was an opportunity to tell a much bigger, richer, more layered story of the war. And so it stopped being just this kind of very narrow account of 809 story, although I hope I brought that to life with, drama and excitement and in the way that it merits. But alongside that, I realised that there were sort of top secret operations by spy planes flying out of secret island air bases in Chile, a plan to land old Canberra spy planes on the Pan American Highway, refuel them and send them into action, taking photographs of Argentine forces. And on another occasion, a Nimrod spy plane, which, as I say, had been flying off an island airbase off the coast of Chile, nearly being lost on one occasion to interception, and it had to sort of dive down to low over the Beagle Channel to reach safety. And another occasion when it lost an engine and had to come screaming into that short island runway and nearly went off the end of the cliff. You know, there were these sort of pockets of drama that I don't think had ever been written about or sort of discovered before. And so the story became about the much broader effort to protect the carriers from air attack and to provide early warning from mainland South America, from within Chile and even from inside Argentina, of when these raids were being launched. And we used the SAS to provide warning as well, so that there would be some time to prepare the defences of the task force. And so as the war progressed, we became better and better at that. And in the last attack All of those elements came together to protect the carriers from air attack. The attackers were shot down. The Exocet missile went astray because it was successfully defended against by the task force. So, as I say, these various different strands of the story grow increasingly important through the book, alongside these accounts of dogfights into what I think. I mean, I felt in the end that it had sort of turned into the sort of thing that Tom Clancy might write. I mean, a sort of real life sort of non-fiction thriller. And so I really hope I've done justice not just to the fighter pilots men of the Royal Navy ships and submarines, but also to those Royal Air Force pilots who were flying these sort of secret missions, and to the special forces who were at work on the South American mainland as well. It was a really combined effort, and I'm not sure that that's ever been completely understood. Yeah, and we've talked a lot about the Sea Harrier, and undoubtedly that played a critical role in success, but it was really a force of combined arms, the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, the Royal Marines, as well as industry sort of back home, all played their part. And it was spectacular the way it all came together. And I think Britain in 1982 was one of only two countries in the world who could conceivably have mounted an operation like that so far from home.
And why do you think Britain was in that position, therefore, having had all these cutbacks? Why was Britain still paramount in this way?
Well, there was still a sort of vestigial connection with just how broad that approach to things had been in the Second World War. I mean, we still had a radar research establishment. We still had, a department, I think it was somewhere in Surrey, that specialised in birds. So we were able to get reports on the kind of impact that the bird life in the South Atlantic might have on operations. I mean, there was even a note in one of the things that was given to the Sea Harrier squadrons, telling them that the biggest bird in the South Atlantic was the penguin, but that they shouldn't worry because even though they can jump, they can't jump that high, so they're unlikely to be. You found humour in some of the sort of official reports and things as well, but there was an enormous amount of expertise that while it may have been neglected in 1982, had not vanished altogether. So, I mean, I love the story from Farnborough of the Department of Defensive Weapons, who had a chap called Bert, whose job was to make Airfix models of Sea Harriers and Harriers, which they would then kind of stick up on the roof of the Aviation Medicine Department, sort of flat roof of the sort of Aviation Medicine Department, sort of prefab, and measure how different camouflage schemes would make those aeroplanes sort of less visible from a distance. And Bert's efforts to build Harriers and the efforts of John Barley, who was an expert in aeroplane camouflage, to provide the Sea Harriers with a new specialised camouflage scheme for the South Atlantic, were all things that are unfolding alongside the training of 809 Squadron. So these wonderful sort of little boffin departments that were all contributing to success.
That was Roland White. Harrier 809, Britain's legendary jump jet and the untold story of the Falklands War, has recently been published by Bantam Press. Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. On our next podcast, which is out tomorrow, Roger Morehouse will be giving a lecture on the invasion of Poland in 1939.